Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
It's good to be home. I was traveling for the last little over 2 weeks, and I think as you get older, you really miss home, and it's good to be back. I miss so much sleep. I've got a cold, so I'm not tired physically, but mentally, I'm just not quite there. But at least with this sermon, I have everything written down word for word, so I don't have to worry about that. My son and his wife and two of his three children, we flew to Copenhagen, Denmark, and which is 6 hours ahead of us. And so I went with 48 hours with no sleep, because that night, you know, it's like a day and a half getting there, and then I'm not tired. It's not my bedtime. So I lay down in the bed, but never got a wink of sleep. And then I had a sleep deficit on the cruise because I said to my son, let's have Allie, she's a 13-year-old one, come in our room. That's Jacob and I. He's 19. And I'm forgetting that that teenagers stay up really late, and I don't, but I did. And then I had to get up early because we were going out on a different port every morning. So the deficit just kept building and building until I came down with a really bad cold on the way home. So. You can probably hear it in my voice. My voice is deeper. Let me see what time I start so I don't go over time. Back in the 1970s, I had an interesting conversation with a young man at Sabbath services in the Washington, D.C. area. He was telling me about a trip to North Carolina he was about to make to visit his grandfather, and it would be the Days of Unleavened Bread. And he was really apprehensive about telling his grandfather about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So when he got back, I saw him, and I said to him, well, how'd it go? And he said, you wouldn't believe what happened. He said, I told my grandfather I couldn't eat toast, and he asked why, and I told him it was the Days of Unleavened Bread. And he said, my grandfather told me when he was a young teenager, his family kept the Sabbath and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And I said, well, did you ask him what church it was? And he said, yes. And he said, my grandfather said he didn't know, because right after that, he ran away from home. And he never had any contact with the group anymore. So that was very interesting. About the same time, my daughter was born, and we had a midwife deliver the baby. And not a nurse midwife. This was called a granny midwife. This is somebody who's somebody else, you know, passes it down. In her case, it was her mother and her grandmother. They all had been midwives in that family. And I had a lot of time to sit there and talk with the lady. And there was something I really wanted to find out. I had heard she kept the Sabbath and holy days. And so her name was Ida Benson. And so for hours we talked. And she had never heard the name of our church, didn't know anything about it. But every year, this woman would go out in her front yard and kill a lamb right there and spread the blood of a lamb on her doorpost. So she didn't quite understand she didn't have to do that. But she did it, you know. She did it year after year for 50 years by the time I met her. And I said, well, the name of her church was Philadelphia Church of the Firstborn. And I said, well, where did you come from? And she said, a man named Elder Perry came to Delaware from the Tidewater, Virginia area. You know, Tidewater is where Norfolk, Virginia Beach, you know, Hampton Roads is, Newport News. And he had come there 50 years earlier and raised up a church of 50 people. And she had a book telling about their church, and I wanted to see it, but somebody had taken it, so I never did find out more about it. But, and again, I kept wondering, you know, where did all these people get this truth from? You know, this lady and the young boy. What was the connection, the long-ago link with those we trace our history, our spiritual ancestors from? The true and full understanding of any matter comes only with a knowledge and understanding of origins. You'll have to wait till the end of the sermon or near the end for me to tell you where her church came from. I did find out. As far as young boy came, the young boy that came to services, I never did find out. But there was a lot of little groups around in the United States back from the early 1900s on who kept the Sabbath and holy days. You know, there was 30 Sabbath-keeping churches in the Washington, D.C. area. A minister of the Church of God Seventh Day told me that. He was talking with the minister of one of them, and he said, at Passover, he said, what do you use, wine or grape juice? And their minister said, water. And he said, water? He said, yeah. He said, it just says fruit of the vine. He said, haven't you ever cut a watermelon open? So, again, they have different beliefs. Some of them do. But he was surprised at that, you know. But that's what the Bible says, fruit of the vine, you know. It doesn't actually say wine, but we know what that means. So, up until the late 1960s, all I knew about church history came from about five sources. Several correspondence course lessons, one booklet by Dr. Hay that we had, Duggar and Dodd's book, History of the True Church. But I had heard for a number of years about a special library that this Seventh-day Church of God minister had. He had married my cousin and his wife, and they had originally been members of their church. And so I contacted him, and I went down there in 1968 to read his books. He had between 2,000 and 3,000 books, a lot of them on church history. The most fascinating thing was he had all their old magazines that they produced from the middle 1800s on. And I read every one of them. I would sit there for hours and read and read and read. And they were interesting. You know, that they didn't have any bound historical things. One book he did have that was interesting, it was published, I believe, in 1845 or 1875, right in there. I mean, 1745, 1775. It was called Martyr's Mirror. And it was published at Ephrata, Pennsylvania. You can go there. That was a German Sabbatarian community. The state of Pennsylvania now allows people to go in free, and they give tours. But these people had the only printing press other than the one Benjamin Franklin had in colonial days. Ben Franklin's was in Philadelphia. And they would publish books. Well, they published this Martyr's Mirror. It was a Mennonite book. The Mennonites were German also. So they asked them to produce this. They had all these accounts of their ministers and members who had been persecuted over in Europe back in the early days. And they wanted that known. And so it was quite the book. He got those books. He worked at the Library of Congress part-time. And anytime they were throwing books out, he would get them, anything valuable. He belonged to something you probably heard of, Antiquarian Society, where you can request a book, and if somebody sees it, they'll contact you, and you can get it. The other one was he had gotten to know the top Hebrew and Greek scholar for the Seventh-day Adventist Church that was headquartered right there in Tacoma Park. And it's hard to swallow. And so when that man died, his widow contacted this Mr. Olson and said, the Adventist hierarchy is coming over to get my husband's books, but I'll give you first pick if you come over right now. So he went over there, and he got some of the best books that he could have ever gotten. And also, since he was really into books and he was very intelligent, his wife was too. She read Hebrew, and she was Jewish, so she read Hebrew and spoke Hebrew. And she had a master's degree. She was a teacher. But they left him their books. I mean, people who were in the church back in the late 1800s, you know, all of them left him their library. So he accumulated quite a library there. So again, I was able over many years to further my quest for the knowledge and understanding of origins as it related to church history. As I stated last time, what I will convey to you today came from many sources. In addition to the ones I listed in that last sermon, that was part two, I'll add three others. The Story of the Church of God, Seventh Day, by Robert Coulter. He was their president several times over the years. Six Papers on the History of the Church of God by Richard Nichols. And History of the Church of God, Seventh Day, by John Kiesz, K-I-E-S-Z. Let's briefly review what was covered in part two. That actually occurred back in February. It's hard to believe this amount of time's gone by. Last time we went back to the days just after the apostles. Part one was the 12 apostles. And examined just how the apostles, how apostasy developed in the church. We saw how a valiant few stood up for the teachings of Christ and the apostles in those early centuries, and how the church had to flee outside the bounds of the Roman Empire after 325 AD, and with remnants of the Christian religion being found in the Isles of Britain and the Alpine regions of Europe. It's hard to swallow, but I can feel that I guess it's from up here. It's just coming down in my throat. The Celtic Church sent hundreds, if not thousands, of graduates of their training schools to evangelize Britain, Europe, Alpine Europe especially, and other areas of the world during the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, clearly understanding their God-given mission to preach the gospel to the known world at that time and to make disciples. Through the dark ages that would follow, only glimpses of God's people here and there would emerge in record books and historical accounts. Now, I want to just stop right here and do some housekeeping things. Two things were left undone last time. One of them was I had a book, Ivor Fletcher's History of God's True Church. There's another word in there, but anyways, about God's true church. And lots of times when I say something that's not in my notes, that's when I get in trouble. So I had the book in my hand, and I said, this little paperback selling on eBay for about $600. And at the time, that's what I thought it was. And then afterwards, I was talking with somebody back at the table, and we were talking about that, and I thought, wait a minute, is it $600? So an elder had told me, he saw it on there. So I went to the elder, and I asked him, I saw him the following week, and I said, Jim, was that 600? He said, no, I think it was more 300 to 400. So I wanted to correct that. I know you probably think, why is he doing this after all this time? Well, it's just because I wanted to tell you the truth. And the other thing, I told you that I was going to tell you something at the end that I had mentioned about Columba, and then I ran out of time and I forgot. I thought of it as soon as I sat down. So I want to do that now. Columba was an apostle. An apostle back there in Scotland in the 5th century. On the trip I was in, on taking a cruise on Loch Ness, that's where the Loch Ness monster is. Didn't see him this time, but others did. You know, it's pretty convincing, some of the stories we heard, you know. But apparently Columba went there to meet with the Pict king. There's a fort right on the lake. And he said he saw a monster. It ate three men. And now, you never know when this is an embellishment later on in history, you know, to the original account, but he was in that area. But he's the one who was of royalty, and both warring sides trusted him with Jacob's pillar stone. And he kept it right there. He even slept on it. I don't know how he slept on something that hard, but here's the story I was going to tell you and skipped right over because I forgot that I had told you that and I had to quick hurry up after that. This is from a magazine called The Sabbath Sentinel. It's been published since around 1948-49 and just by a group of Sabbath keepers from different groups. It's called Celtic Sabbath Keepers, research by Richard Nichols. And he talks about Columba. And here's what one old source says. And this source was Professor James Moffat, the one who had the Moffat version of the Bible. He was a professor of church history at Princeton. He says, and this is a quote, this is a quote from a Dr. A. Butler. I guess it was in Moffat's presentation. And I quote, having continued his labors in Scotland 34 years, he, meaning Columba, clearly and openly foretold his death, and on Saturday, the 9th of June, said to his disciple Diarmuid, this day is called the Sabbath, that is the rest day, and such will it truly be to me, for it will put an end to my labors. That's from Butler's Lives of the Saints. In a footnote, the Catholic historian Bellesheim says, "We seem to see here an allusion to the custom observed in the early monastic church of Ireland of keeping the day of rest on Saturday or the Sabbath." So even they acknowledged that it was Saturday. And it's amazing. Columba knew he was right hours away from death. And so he saw the analogy there that his labors were going to be over. I got some of the papers here. I don't know what to do with them. But I wanted to, I've been holding that in my mind now for 5 months. I thought I've got to do what I said I was going to do. So now back to our story. Last time we left off in the Dark Ages, where you could see remnants of the church. You know, sometimes there'd be 20 or 30,000 of them in different areas in the 1500s. And but again, the 1300 and or 1260 days of, you know, a year for a day had ended then, right at that point in history. And in about 1585, almost immediately after the end of those 1260 years in the wilderness, God's church begins to revive. Sabbath keepers in England now commonly come into historical view, and books were published urging the keeping of the seventh day. Names such as John Trask, Theophilus Brayborn, and Philip Tandy preached that the seventh-day Sabbath was to be observed. And John Trask laid hands on four evangelists, it says, who cured diseases. God does the curing, but again, they anointed people with oil, and people were made whole. One of these four evangelists kept the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. Many of these leaders were sent to prison for their beliefs, and it wasn't a time where it was full, you know, freedom of religion. One actually raised up a congregation while in prison among the inmates. Another, John Trask, actually recanted. He actually, after going this way of life and publishing books and all, he recanted. It said that he still believed the Sabbath the seventh day was the Sabbath, but he didn't want to die, I suppose. He renounced his beliefs and was released. But his wife would not. And so she stayed another 15 to 16 years in prison in horrible, horrible conditions, eating rotten food that was given her. And I believe she was in the Tower of London. And, I mean, just terrible, terrible conditions that she was in. And she died there. Francis Bamfield, another leader in the church in the 1600s, was put in prison. And on page 181 of Ivor Fletcher's book, he states, and I quote, "Francis Bamfield spent most of his life from 1662 onwards either in prison or on the run from the authorities. Even when detained at Dorchester Prison, his leadership and speaking ability resulted in large crowds of people from the town flocking to the prison to hear him preach." But the only thing is, he was a Trinitarian. Now, you know, you'll see so much of this in church history where these people have all these truths, but there'd be one thing or two things where they just didn't understand. You'll see that. By 1668, there were 9 or 10 congregations keeping the seventh-day Sabbath in England. The most famous, the Mill Yard Congregation, dates from 1607, although some records say claim 1580s. According to Brian Ball, on page 21 of his book, The Seventh-day Men, published in 1994, Thomas Bamfield even contended that the seventh day had been kept in England in unbroken succession until the 13th century. And you'll see that in Scotland and in Ireland also, up into the 17th and 19th centuries, that there were people keeping it. Among these early leaders in England was the Stennett family, which provided 4 generations of ministers. The Bamfield brothers, Francis and Thomas, wrote books that opened the minds of others. And I've actually seen their books. And, you know, these books are 450 years old now. And I've held them in my hands. They're leather-bound books, real big books. And that time I went up there to Janesville, Wisconsin, to the Seventh-day Baptist headquarters, they have most of the books anybody has on that subject. Francis Bamfield died in prison, but the congregation he organized continued for over 100 years. By the middle of the 1600s, nonconformists in England faced persecution and imprisonment for their beliefs. And because of this hostile environment, some decided to immigrate to the New World, where one colony called Rhode Island offered religious freedom. Before these early Sabbatarian congregations were completely swallowed up by apostasy, Jesus Christ would establish his church on the shores of North America in a place called Newport in Rhode Island. On page 195 in Ivor Fletcher's book, The Incredible History of God's True Church, that's what it is, he asks the question, who was the first Sabbath keeper in America? He says it's not known, but the first recorded Sabbatarian was Stephen Mumford, who came to America from England in 1664. Now, you can go up into New England and you can find things where they have dates before that. I don't know if there were people before him or these were just, you know, people that heard something and then tried to put it down and got the wrong date, you know, were 20 years earlier. Or, you know, it's hard to say. This book says there may have been others prior to Mumford, for as early as 1646, Sabbath discussion embroiled New England. Some of the earliest books published in America supported the keeping of the seventh-day Sabbath. Now, I would imagine some of those were Puritan books, and they called Sunday the Sabbath. That may be what they're looking at there, but I think there was some that were written by people who were talking about Saturday Sabbath. The Baptist historian Griffiths reports that in the earliest Sabbath keepers were at Newport, Rhode Island in 1644. He's got 20 years earlier. It is said that in the province of Rhode Island, there were adherents of that faith, Sabbath keepers, at its early settlement, contemporary with the founding of the First Baptist Church. The church organized by Mumford in 1671 was the first church of the Sabbatarian Baptists in America. Yet it appears, however, that there were already in existence in New England at that time some 30 other Seventh-day Baptist churches, although they were not so named. That name came in 1818. Another writer, a Seventh-day Adventist, also maintains 30 other Sabbatarian churches in New England prior to Mumford's coming. Some of these were said to have sprung from seven known Church of God Seventh-day in London at the time of the Puritan migrations to the New World. They also used the name Church of God, a name still retained by several groups. There was a feast I went to in Saratoga Springs in 1990, and there was another elder there who was really interested in church history, and he told me a story about people coming there for the feast the year before and coming up at the end of the feast and telling him that there was a bookstore in Saratoga Springs that had a book, and it was called The History of the Sabbatarian Churches in New England. And they wanted to buy it, but it was $1,000. This was a very rare bookstore. And they said it was almost like letters, you know, bound together. And so we immediately went over to that bookstore. He knew where it was and searched through the whole bookstore, but we couldn't find it. Somebody had bought it. And I thought, wow, if we had only found that book, we could have really nailed the history of the church in America, you know. It would have given everything, you know. But since then, I thought there's a possibility that what they were looking at was another book, a book by a lady who wrote this book in 1851. She was a Sabbatarian in New England. Her name was Tamar Davis. And her book was called A General History of the Sabbatarian Churches. Now, they said, no, this was about just New England. So it may have been different, but the thing about her book, I've seen it in libraries, it has the old type, you know, where the pages are covered, and then it's like these two little binders, and there's like a rope to turn, you know, you string around there to keep it shut. And that would maybe give the impression the people may never have opened it and thought it was letters, you know. But again, they said the name was History of the Sabbatarian Church in New England. So again, we would have loved to have had that. It's more likely, again, that Mumford simply decided to migrate to America as a result of the difficult circumstances caused by the laws that were passed in England enforcing conformity to the teachings of the Church of England. And again, since Rhode Island was one of the few places in the world he could go to that guaranteed religious freedom, that may be the main reason for his coming. And there was a minister named John James that was killed right then, right before he left, and in 1663, so that may have triggered it. For a while, Stephen Mumford associated with the members of a Sunday Baptist church, and several members of that church started to embrace his views. Now, you think, well, why would he do that? Why would he go from a Sabbatarian church in London to a Sunday-keeping church? In the old correspondence course, it says that Mumford, they thought he was a minister. They said he was sent over to America, and they said he came from the Bell Lane Church in London. All those turned out to be not true. And there was something else right there in, it was called, for the ministry, called Reviews You Can Use. And when they changed doctrine, the ministers were calling it Reviews You Can Lose. So here's what was written in there. It says, Mumford's move to Rhode Island was pivotal, but it was not planned by man. We have no evidence that Mumford was a member of the London churches. He probably fled England to escape its increasing intolerant religious atmosphere. Rhode Island offered him the religious liberty that England did not. When the Newport congregation was established, it was William Hiscox, a convert, who was chosen to lead them, not Mumford. Nevertheless, it was Mumford whom God used to establish the Sabbath in the colonies. Mumford sailed from London, but he did not come from London. He and his wife were members of the Tewkesbury Baptist congregation, later called the Natahn Church. In 1986, Oscar Burdick discovered that the record book of this church had recently been deposited in the Gloucestershire County Record Office. Among the members listed were the Mumfords. The Natahn Church was a mixed congregation containing both Sabbath keepers and Sunday observers. This perhaps explains why Stephen Mumford, upon his arrival in Newport, so readily worshipped with the Sunday Observing Baptist Church located there. So I think that pretty well makes it clear. You know, a lot of people wonder, well, why did he do that? where was I now? In fact, 11 people had come to understand about the Sabbath from the Mumfords. But in 1669, because one of the Baptist ministers preaching a very fiery sermon against keeping the Sabbath, four of them, two men and their wives, renounced their beliefs and returned to their former Sunday worship. Stephen Mumford was in America 7 years when these seven people, including himself, started the first known congregation of God's church in America. They called it the Church of God. And it started on January 3rd, 1672. They had the old style calendar back then, too. It was December 23rd, 1671, but same date. They were going from the Julian to, I forget which it was there back then. With four men and three women. God always starts small, seven members in what was to become the smallest state in the United States. The very first convert in America was a woman. Her name was Tassie Hubbard. Now, Ron Kelly, back in our former affiliation, had a 12-part series on church history, and he states that, I'll quote, it says, Tassie was regarded as the first native-born American to convert to Sabbath-keeping, but Seventh-day Baptists have records that show that she was actually born in England in 1609, so she wasn't the first American to embrace the Sabbath, and people over here already. Again, this was in 1665, and her husband, Samuel Hubbard, a successful businessman in Newport, first tried to prove her wrong, but again accepted the truth about the Sabbath 3 weeks after his wife did. The other five people besides the Hubbards were their daughter, Rachel Langworthy, who had almost a photographic memory of the Bible. She was really gifted. And when they would have a debate or whatever, she would be there because she could bring up the scripture and tell where it was. And she was really had a gift for something like that. William Hiscox, Roger Baster, apparently a lifelong bachelor until his death at age 66, and Stephen Mumford and his wife, Anne. You can see the graves of all these people. Has anybody here ever gone up to Newport, Rhode Island? It's really worth seeing if you're ever near there. All their graves are there, you know. Stephen and Anne, you can see their graves. They're buried side by side. Apparently, none of their children ever embraced their views, their beliefs. But their gravestones are there, and the Mumford house is still there. You know, it was, it's been there since 40-something. It's a very beautiful house. I don't know how much of it existed back then. You know how it is. They keep remodeling and adding things that the termites have taken away, you know. But again, it's a beautiful house. The church building also is in Newport, dating from the early 1700s, is still there. And today it houses the Newport Historical Society. The church records dating back to 1692 are there. The ones before there were burned in a fire along with the original church. William Hiscox became their first minister and served from 1671 until his death in 1704. Upon William Hiscox's death, William Gibson, who had come over from England in 1675 as an already ordained minister, became the minister of the Newport Church. The little congregation kept in touch with other members and ministers over in England during these formative years. Dr. Edward Stennett of the Bell Lane Church in London wrote a letter to the Sabbath Keepers of Newport, dated February 2, 1668. This was 3 years before the church was even established. They had apparently asked him for advice of how to proceed in regard to their First Day Baptist affiliation. Dr. Stennett stated that there were 9 or 10 Sabbath-keeping churches left in England, this is a quote, plus many scattered disciples in this tottering day when many eminent churches have been shattered to pieces. All of this, end of quote, all of this happened at a time when the light of the truth was about to flicker out in England. I have a thing I took out of our old church newspaper of 30 years ago or more, of a lady who was in a church in England from the turn of the century on with her father. Her father was a minister who anointed sick people with oil. And she told how, anybody wants to look at it, I'll have it. She showed how one day they all decided, wait a minute, we're worshiping on the wrong day, and they went to Sunday. And she said they kicked them out. She says in here, they actually threw stones at us. So again, you can see what was happening in London, in England for several hundred years, you know, until there was hardly anything left. Let's see, where was I here? Growth in membership was slow. The entire population of Rhode Island back then was less than 3,000. Joseph and Bethia Clark, Ruth Burdick, and Mrs. Maxson soon joined the original seven. In 1678, Samuel Hubbard reported that there was a total of 37 Sabbatarians in America, 20 in Newport, 7 at Westerly, and 10 in New London, Connecticut. As time went on, many of the Newport members migrated west several miles, and so a church in Westerly, Rhode Island, was established in 1680. During the 1700s, the Westerly Church would go on to grow to a membership of 969, with over 3,000 being baptized in a baptismal pool there. Over 3,000. And so this became the leading the headquarters congregation. In 1681, there were 29 members at Newport, one at Providence, 4 in Plymouth Colony, 5 at Martha's Vineyard, 2 of whom were Indians, 1 at Narragansett, 7 at Westerly, and 4 in New London. 7 in New London had left the church with differing doctrines and became members of the nucleus of the Rogerine Sabbatarians. And I have a whole lot here. There's a book in the library here in outside of Columbus on them. It's a fascinating study. It just shows there's always splits, and back then there was no different. Let me just read you something here about those Indians. I thought it was interesting. What did I do with that? Here it is. This is from a book called Sabbath and Sectarianism in 17th Century England by David S. Katz, published in 1988. In page 174, he says here, The following year, 1681, Samuel Hubbard wrote a somewhat longer letter to Edward Stennett back in London, recounting the story of the conversion of two Indians, an old man and his son, who had apparently been baptized at Nantucket and then sent out to spread the gospel among his people. This is a former Sunday-keeping group. These two Indians, this is a quote, these two Indians came to Brother Hiscock's house, Hubbard recounted, and they had a reasoning together. The old Indian had a Bible in his own language. Can you imagine that? This is the 1680s, and this Indian has a Bible, a complete Bible, written in his native tongue. I don't know, you know, I guess some early missionaries did that. His own language, and was found to be sound in what he knew. After much discourse, they reasoned about Jehovah's Seventh-day Sabbath, and then after much discourse, the old man said, I thought a little water sprinkled was baptism, but God have, opened my eyes. Now I see it is not. God can open my mind to see the Sabbath also. By the end of the discussion, the pair of Indians were won over to the Saturday Sabbath, and they were baptized by Hiscox in Newport, and had hands laid on them and broke bread with the church. Their initiation completed, they returned to Martha's Vineyard where they lived in a canoe. And so he shows that his work among these Indians there in that island bore fruit among some of their family members. So I thought that was interesting. There's little things you never hear about, you know. But they're human factors. You know, I'm trying to make this not, this happened in 1805, you know, trying to make it about people. You know, that's what holds your attention. Okay, we now come to the events of the 1700s. That's the 1600s in the United States, 1700s. Newport is one of three centers from which all Sabbatarian churches in America sprang. The other two were Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Piscataway, New Jersey. As far as Philadelphia goes, four Sabbatarian churches began here in the late 1600s and early 1700s. Few historical records exist, though, and they apparently died out by the early 1800s. The second Sabbath-keeping church in America was founded in Newtown, you know, similar to Newport, Rhode Island, Newtown, Pennsylvania, in 1697. And this church sent out colonies into Maryland, South Carolina, and Georgia. Church records show there was a church in Nottingham, Pennsylvania, just west-northwest of Newark, Delaware. I read an account in the histories back there of a man from near where I live, north of there, near Smyrna, Delaware. He actually, by horseback, went all the way up there to be baptized. And as far as I know, he was the only one from Delaware, state of Delaware, where I live. And there was a group there. The old correspondence course showed that on a map of the United States where that church in Nottingham is just across the Maryland line in Pennsylvania. But in Westchester, in a historical society, one time I went in and was doing church history research, and I asked the lady, she said, oh, yeah, there's something in this big book. Well, I opened this book, and it went back into the late 1700s, and it showed how there was a stone church building that these people had built, and I guess there was about 100 of them. And then as time went on, you know, people die and generations don't stay with it. And then there was only 50, and then finally got down to about 10. And then they moved into the farmhouse. They had their services in a farmhouse there. And then finally there was only 3, and there was only 2, and there was only 1, and then she died. And it actually, you know, the people who were keeping the history of the record, they were watching these people, and it's amazing that they kept track of it all down through like 100 and some years, you know. And again, you can find those records sometime. Then the other center was Piscataway, New Jersey, close on the heels of and intimately associated with the Newport and Philadelphia Center was the third center here, Piscataway. I did find out a lot about those. I was waiting for my son to finish classes at the University of Delaware one time, which isn't too far from New Jersey. And I happened to put in Seventh-day Sabbath, and up came a book by a state archivist, a New Jersey state archivist. And I thought, well, why would this be? So I asked for it, and they brought it out. And he had spent, I don't know how long, state money, I guess, because he said, this is a historical treasure for New Jersey. And he went and he told all about these people, what they believed and everything. It was really interesting. I would have never known a lot. I went to one of the churches they had there at Shiloh, which is really across from Lewis, Delaware, you know, actually up a little bit. But I went there, and they had a Seventh-day Baptist church there now. But I walked through the graveyards, and here were gravestones from the early 1700s. And I thought, well, you know, everything changed when the Seventh-day Baptist took over and changed the name and all the doctrines. But here were people I thought that when the first resurrection comes, there's going to be people, I think, come out of those graves, because here they believe like we did. Those people had the same beliefs that we did. Not as full, you know, a lot of them back then, you might think, well, God's people always kept, in this country, kept the Passover on the 14th of Nisan. Well, they didn't. There was some groups, a few groups that did, the majority didn't. It took a while. It took into the middle 1800s for them all to correspond with each other, and they realized, yes, this is what we should be doing. Again, in Piscataway, though, a church began in 1705, which resulted in others being established. And a lot of the members went west into western Virginia, which at that time was Virginia, but it became West Virginia, and also western Pennsylvania. But again, the old Piscataway Church book relates its founding as, and I quote, "the Church of God, keeping the commandments of God in the faith of Jesus Christ, living in Piscataway and Hopewell," unquote. One main factor affecting the church back then was the Revolutionary War. It took its toll both physically and spiritually on these churches. Piscataway members, this is a quote, differed among themselves in relation to the justness of the war. Some of the members joined the Patriot Army, with one minister becoming an army chaplain. Some fled to the mountains of the north, and some stayed to have their farms devastated by the war machine. Another sister church, the Shrewsbury, New Jersey Church, sold their church building and on September 6, 1789, moved as a body to Woodbridge Town, Pennsylvania, and then to Salem, West Virginia. I have actually been in that church building. It's just a log cabin, and they've preserved it. And you can actually go. It's like in a state park or something, and you can actually go. And the men sat on one side and the women on the other side. They didn't sit together. From the Rhode Island and New Jersey movements sprang churches in New York State, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Many had joined the local churches after having accepted the doctrinal argument of the Sabbath, but as time went on, only a few were really drawing close to God. The fruits of their lives showed that only, again, a small number had deeply repented of their former ways, and so false teachers were able to come in and lead these people away from the truth of God. We now come to the 1800s. Okay, we've gone through the 1600s, 1700s. This is the 1800s, where two major departures from the faith occurred. On my August 2003 trip to Rhode Island, I saw a conference record from 1808 showing a close affiliation of churches in Rhode Island, New Jersey, and New York, and also listing churches in England. So again, they did have communication. They knew each other as brethren, in other words. Small groups of Sabbath keepers existed in small towns across the land. Most of the congregations back then were located in rural areas and not in large cities, and that was because of the Industrial Revolution with its six-day work week. There was no inroads made in big cities like that back then for the most part. And God's truth took root in the common folk of the agriculturally based economies. Independent groups of families of Sabbath keepers existed throughout all this period in New York, West Virginia, Ohio, Michigan, and elsewhere. The one thing I came upon one time was the fact that there was, back in the middle 1800s or like 1860, there was a Church of God group right here. Now, I say right here, I don't know if it was, but it said it was on the banks of the, what's the river comes through here? Somebody said it over here, what? No. Yeah, no, the other one. It comes right down through McLean's farm area there. No, it's not. No, it wasn't. No, I'll come to it later in my thing. Anyways, I don't know because it actually comes from West Liberty and it flows in, this river flows into, the Mad River, that's it, the Mad River. It flows into, my mind is very tired. It flows into the town I come by to get here, the big town outside of Dayton. Anyways, it flows there and I think over towards Dayton then. But it didn't say where it was. It just said it was on the banks of the Mad River. So it showed people were here then. Again, some were taken into fellowship back then who held wrong doctrines. Such as the belief in an immortal soul, Trinity, taking part in war. One man who held such beliefs had sons who would become ministers who taught these wrong doctrines. Leaven leavens the whole lump, God says. And this man had a lot of his family, sons, grandsons, great-grandsons, who all became ministers in the church who then influenced people to change the name to Seventh-day Baptist. Again, a have-love philosophy was advocated toward those of differing beliefs. And the general trend among Sabbath-keeping churches during the 19th century seems to have been that they desired to be more and more like the churches around them. Protestant doctrines and holidays were now prevalent in Sabbath-keeping congregations. And again, this led to an outright split. Several congregations in 1818 organized themselves into a new organization. This group officially adopted the name Seventh-day Baptist. And by 1828, 16 to 20 congregations were being represented at the Seventh-day Baptist Conference. While they spoke disparagingly of other, I quote, fanatical and unworthy Sabbath keepers. That's a direct quote from one of their own books, entitled The Seventh-day Baptists in Europe and America. Again, they were referring to those who remained in the dozen or so congregations that had not gone along with them. And again, this was back in the early 1800s. Within 50 years, another major split would also occur. The Advent movement began among Sunday churches by William Miller and several other of his followers. And they first learned about the Sabbath from a Seventh-day Baptist woman, a widow named Rachel Oakes Preston, from New York State, while she was visiting her daughter in New Hampshire in early 1844. And it was not until after the disappointment, that means Christ didn't come when they thought, of 1844, as they expected, that many of this group embraced this truth of the Seventh-day Sabbath. But they didn't join the Seventh-day Baptists, but instead some of them began to assemble with the remnant of the true church who had refused to be affiliated with the Seventh-day Baptist Conference. Although they called themselves the Church of God, these Adventists were never spiritually a part of the true church. They had only associated themselves with God's people for a season. That's right out of the correspondence course there. They looked to a prophetess named Ellen G. White and believed that her frequent visions were direct revelations from God. In 1860, they rejected the name Church of God as being indistinctive and a mark of fanaticism. This was, again, as a direct result of one of Ellen G. White's visions. At a conference in Battle Creek, Michigan that year, they officially adopted this Seventh-day Adventist name, a name that came to Ellen G. White in a vision, with only one delegate from Gilboa, Ohio, voting against it and holding out for the name Church of God. This decision marked the beginning of what was to become two separate organizations proclaiming significantly different messages. If you can turn in your Bibles to 2 Corinthians, I do want to have at least one scripture. 2 Corinthians 11, verses 3 and 4. 2 Corinthians 11, verses 3 and 4. Second Corinthians 11, verses 3 and 4. It says, "But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it." But see, Ellen G. White had all kinds of different doctrines, you know, the second angel's message and, you know, all types of things. They didn't have the same beliefs as these people they had come among. And again, the only thing I can think of back then is here was two upheavals among God's people within 50 years. And as I mentioned, back in the early centuries when that happened, it had to have been very hard on people in the church because they were all intermarried. And I'm sure there was a lot of intermarriage between the Seventh-day Baptists that left and the people who stayed with the truth and with this group. So it had to have torn up a lot of families again. It had to be hard on them. And among these books down in this man's basement, he had a book called The Early Writings of Ellen G. White, and then he had another one called The Early Writings of Ellen G. White, which was a later one. And he showed how they dropped out all kinds of just crazy things that she taught. And yet when he would present this to people and they say, "Oh, no, there never was an early book," but he had it and I actually saw it and read it. So, you know, it was there. We might ask, you know, who were these people calling themselves the Church of God who were deceived into accepting this different gospel and different spirit? Again, for the most part, it was these people who had come out of the Advent movement. But again, it was the children and grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, of those who stood up for the truth 40 years earlier in a similar falling away in the Seventh-day Baptist movement. I can see that I'm running out of time. I only got about 10 more minutes, so I'm going to skip over. I don't want to give a part four. There was one family named Cottrell that was in the church for generations. I mean, these people came, they were persecuted back in Europe, and they came to Newport, Rhode Island. And there were seven generations in the Church of God. They wouldn't go along with Ellen G. White either. They left and formed the Church of God. But that's interesting. There's several strong families, you know, that keep the truth going over time. And let's see. The church grew because they had a magazine, and they were able to unify God's people. People would send in questions, or they'd send in something they were studying in the Bible, and others would add or show what was wrong. And so, you know, God's people, only numbering in a couple thousand here, were able to grow. And it really didn't take off until a series of strong leadership came along where they had a printing press. And one man actually, I got two versions, he either sold the money he was saving to buy a house or he sold his house and to save the work because the building, they were losing the building, the printing press had been repossessed, and he saved the work, you know. And there was a lot of men who stood in the gap during those years. One of the most interesting leaders back then was Andrew Duggar. Andrew Duggar was a very brilliant man. He had a degree he went to the University of Chicago. I think he had a degree. He was on the debating team. He was really good at it. And he would go into towns all over the United States, and they would have like a camp or a tent meeting or whatever, and he would take out a newspaper ad and publicize it and also challenge some of the ministers there to a debate about is it Sunday or Saturday. And he could always win it. He could always win it just because he knew how to let them say and just win to, you know, bring the scriptures in and everything. And this minister, Wilford Olson, whose books I read, he traveled with him as a young man. And he said it was amazing. He could go into a town and raise a church of 50 people up almost overnight. He said the only problem was when they came through there 6 months later, everybody was gone, you know. And another thing they did is they formed a national conference. They moved their headquarters to Stanbury, Missouri, and they had a national conference. Up until this time, the tithes were just given to the ministers out there. And these ministers could actually solicit people for tithes. They would actually write to them and say, I'd like to have your tithes. And Duggar sent out a questionnaire to everybody and asked them, who do you send your tithes to? And if you could tell us how much, you know, I guess that was optional. But it turned out that about 40% of everybody was sending their tithes to one man who did very little, didn't do much preaching, and he owned a very, very prosperous farm. So he had a good thing going. And so when Duggar did that, a lot of these men who were getting most of the money, nothing was getting accomplished, they really, you know, really rose up and tried to stop all this. But again, the work they were doing really took off after that. let me just skip ahead here. Here's something that was said that was written that sort of unified people. I thought it was very touching, and I quote Mrs. Jacob Brinkerhoff, the one who sold his house. It says, it has long been known that our cause is one in the East and in the West, that we are one people in faith and doctrine, one in hope and Christian unity, and a unity of organization is desired. In carrying out the apostolic commission to teach other people and make believers, to preach the gospel into all the world and to take out of the world a people for the name of the Lord and for his coming kingdom, it is necessary for that work to be done to the best advantage. And all know this is best done by a concerted action. Again, he tells how. Also, a union of conferences is desirable, making the people one people, and by which we can labor more effectually. So again, I thought that was interesting. He said that. I've got so much material here. I don't know how I got it all in the one sermon there years ago. I know I'm talking slower today because of my mind not being as quick. Duggar had an idea back in 1925 to erect a broadcasting station in mid-America that would be powerful enough to reach all of the United States and Canada and even into Europe and Asia. And people sent in donations for this project, but very little ever came of it. They never did that. That would wait to, you know, another 10 years with our work doing that. And I thought that was interesting. There was a lot of people called independents back then that didn't want to be a part of an organized group. You know, we have them today, and they had them back then, but they never accomplished much for God. And in most cases, after a couple generations, you know, there was nobody there to help them. And, you know, after a few generations, those families just weren't keeping the Sabbath anymore. But there was a lot of different groups back then. G.G. Rupert, if you want to know more about him, I know about him. There was one called Church of God and Saints in Christ, which was an all-black group. And stayed independent of all the other groups. They kept the Sabbath and holy days as well. They had no, as far as I can tell, there was no contact. They said that God in a vision had revealed the truth to them. So, again, I don't know. Let's see. Okay, I mentioned about the Church of the Firstborn, Philadelphia Church of the Firstborn. That was the midwife's church. Now, going through those newspapers, and also through a book here, it showed that Duggar and his friends, all the Seventh-day Church of God ministers were always bumping into this group and thinking, who are these people? Where did they come from? Where did they get their truth from, you know? But it never said where. But there was one thing, I believe it was Richard Nichols found. He says, for the origins of this group, we must go back to the 1860s. Ellen G. White and her husband made several tours through the eastern and midwestern states, finding many congregations of independent Sabbath keepers. Many refused to join them, couldn't accept her visions and the name Seventh-day Adventist. The whites had ostracized members of the Free Sabbatarians. That was the name of a group that had connected with them, at least. A group in New England that met together in 1864 and 1865 to choose a biblical name. One of the Seventh-day Church of God leaders, Gilbert Kremer, was there. And when they, he was there when they chose, this is these, Free Sabbath Keepers. They wanted a better name. When they chose the name Church of the Firstborn, and I saw in my research that they had a headquarters later on in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So it's not that far down to Virginia. That's probably where that Elder Perry was trained in Philadelphia and came up then into Delaware. So that's probably the origin of that. Let's see. There was an article in the New York Times one time I saw. It was an 1890s article. And there was a group in New York City kept the Sabbath and holy days. Their church split in 1933, and then they came back together, you know, in 1949. They had that split. And but I've saved the best story for last. So many times we read about church history, and they'll believe so many things, and others they don't believe, you know, and you think, well, can't make head or tail of it. This is a story I got off the internet, and to me it's inspiring. It's a group of people that believed exactly like we do, exactly like we do. It's just termed Church of God in Scotland, and this was on next to last day of 1999. I printed it out. So this is the story of Margaret McCormick, now 80 years of age. She lived another 16 years, died at 96. Living in Melbourne, Australia, Margaret, known to all as Meg, was born on January 25th, 1916, at Telswear, in Aylshire, Scotland. Her father died, so she had to go live with her grandfather. Meg's grandfather, Willie Young, was a farmer and lived at Lamlish. He was a Sabbath keeper who belonged to the Church of God. He raised Margaret, and she attended the Church of God, which held services at Whiting Bay, about 3 miles from Lamlish. Services were held on Friday evenings after sunset, Saturday mornings, and again in the afternoon. You're thinking, wow, that's a lot of sitting. But members did not attend all three, but chose the time that suited them best. The church was simply known as the Church of God, with members on all three islands. This is out in the western islands of Scotland. I was just north of there and trying to find out more information. One lady in the one library said she knew if she'd heard those stories, so she knew where they were. Let's see. Says says the building where the congregation of about 200 met was made of sandstone and built with donated labor on a farm. Services consisted of songs, a sermon expounding the scriptures, and lasted about 1.5 hours. Passover was kept on the 14th. The night to be remembered was kept in individual homes. Unleavened bread was observed, and homes were unleavened before Passover, Pentecost, Trumpets, Atonement, Tabernacles, and Last Great Day were also observed. However, no one traveled off the island and kept to keep the feast. Baptism was by immersion. Unclean foods were not eaten, although some pigs were raised and sold to non-members. The only part of the pig used was fat to grease the boots. There was a saying that that was all the pig was good for. It was clearly understood that man's destiny was to be born into the family of God at the resurrection if one remained faithful, where one would be a son of God. The church knew that Britain was Ephraim, the U.S. Manasseh, and parts of France, Reuben, Holland was Zebulun, and so on. While they knew of other churches of God in the Ukraine, Scandinavia, Chile, and China, they were unable to establish contact with them as they wished to remain isolated. I guess they mean the other ones they tried to contact. And again, they knew about Jeremiah coming to Ireland and Hezekiah's daughters and, you know, the coronation stone and tithing. And, you know, I won't go into all of it. But this lady then came in contact with the Church of God in Australia. And you can look at this if you want. A lot of questions were asked her about specific things. And she said that as far as Christianity is concerned, Meg's father-in-law, Hugh McKenzie Sr., said his family had been in the Church of God for many centuries. As far back as records, written or oral, go, Hugh McKenzie's family Bible had a list going back many generations. So these people have been there a long time. And they were able to practice their faith because it's so isolated there. There was nobody to tell them otherwise. No story is more inspiring than the history of the Church of God. It's the story of people just like you and me, men and women facing all kinds of trials and adversities with the Spirit and power of God in their lives. All across America, back through the British Isles and the Alpine Valleys of Europe, and in 1,000 other places we have little or no knowledge of, back through Asia Minor and right back to Jerusalem to the days of Christ and the apostles. That history has yet to be completed, for it continues on with each one of us and with those God will call in the future. I'm sure those living in the millennium will be looking back at our times and lives and will be inspired by how we face the trials and upheavals of the last days. We will be church history. You know, that will be church history for them, and we will be their church history. The world will know us then. It doesn't know us now. We're just a footnote to history. And that's all we are. This world never discovered the true people of God. They never understood the fact that God hasn't been trying to save the world, save all of mankind in this age, or that his plan wasn't to make the world a better place, but to create a new civilization starting with Jesus Christ and the 12 men who would comprise the foundation of that new entity, and continue building on that foundation from the day of Pentecost in 31 AD to our day and beyond. Brethren, these are our spiritual roots. And every now and then it's good to review and to reflect on that rich spiritual heritage we have some knowledge of, and to realize that these eternal truths that we hold so precious also once lived in the hearts and lives of others long before us, who comprise that small and oftentimes scattered flock called the Church of God. And although our knowledge of all the details is imperfect, especially when we go way, way back, you know, we have a lot of knowledge from like 1600 on. But again, there's still people we don't know who lived the last 300 years too, and there were some little group, so we don't know them. But although our knowledge is imperfect, and though their story has but little place in human records, the true and the full history of God's people is for now the precious possession of God, ready to one day be revealed to all who love God's truth.